on planet Earth in the continent called Jambudvipa, where we live. Human beings call this Seshin. Do you know about Seshin? I'm trying to figure it out these days myself. Seshin, some humans on Jambudvipa say, means to gather the mind, to collect the mind, to embrace and sustain the mind. And as I mentioned this morning, we were having another Seshin earlier this morning, and I mentioned that. That is gathering the mind, and that gathering the mind is useful to do because often we feel like there's some pieces that have been scattered out there, some pieces of mind that have been dispersed into the outer environment, and we've lost track of the fact that they are mind. So we have a time now to gather them back, collect all those stray pieces. You might have noticed some like along the side of the road when you were on your way here. That was your mind. So we might have during one of our work periods like a kind of mind collection pickup period where we go out with trash bags and pick up all the pieces of mind along the side of the road. But mostly we're gathering the mind without moving, just right here. Because even while we're sitting here, it seems as if there's all these stray pieces scattered out there. Like, without moving, we can imagine little crumpled up pieces of mind on the side of the road. And so we can gather them in our imagination, since that's where they are right now when we think about them. I don't know if this is the usual way of talking about Seshin, but it's one way, it seems, on Jambudvipa continent. We seem to be projecting things out there that we think are separate from mind. Another phrase that came to mind today was there's this another Jambudvipa resident named Ken Kesey. Do people know Ken Kesey? Mm-hmm. Wow, some people know. Does anyone not know Ken Kesey?
Oh, Ken Kesey.
Ken Kesey, I mean, a whole Dharma talk could probably be given about Ken Kesey. You think he's an author? He maybe is most well known for writing the book One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Once a Great Notion, maybe, did he write? Sometimes a Great Notion. So he was an author, but he's also known for being what's called a merry prankster. And so this was one of those things in the 1960s in the American sector of Jambudvipa, where these merry pranksters got a big school bus and they painted it so that it didn't look like a normal school bus, and they put like lookout towers with periscopes and things like that on the roof, and they wired up all these microphones so they could listen to all the whatever was happening that seemed to be out there, and they would film things out there. So if they got pulled over by the police while they were driving, they would just start filming the police, and the police would get all kind of freaked out and go away. So they just were, this crazy cast of characters, kind of aimlessly wandering around Jambudvipa. And to make a long story short, Ken Kesey had this, I heard, had this this phrase, this instruction when things got really far out for these merry pranksters. His advice was, stay in your own movie. So I think that's another way to talk about Sesshin, or gathering the mind. Again, we, just like we think that those bits and pieces of crumpled stuff on the side of the road is not our mind, we think that there's stuff happening out there that's not our movie. We see some of that stuff and we're like, that's not in my script. I didn't write that one in. I would never have written that one in. And that's your movie. So, you deal with it. It's your movie. My understanding of Ken Kesey's Dharma instructions is that actually there's nothing outside of our movie. And when we think that it's somebody else's movie, and then we start getting involved and maybe trying to fix up their movie or tell them it's the wrong movie or that they should get in our movie or whatever, that we've lost sight of our own movie, like the kind of the fact that everything that's happening is our own movie. So I think that's a great Sesshin guideline also. Stay in your own movie. And recognize that that's what it is. So we also started looking at this Zen teacher whose name is Yellow Cork Tree, sometimes known as Huangbo. He lived on Yellow Cork Tree Mountain. And he said some things like, stay in your own movie. But in these days they didn't have movies, so he said it like, all Buddhas and all sentient beings are only this one mind, besides which nothing exists, or outside of which nothing exists. That we think are other people's movies. Now, it's just our movie. And this one mind is unborn and indestructible and unceasing and in this one mind there's no distinction between Buddhas and sentient beings, except for the fact that sentient beings grasp the characteristics of things. They think they're out, they think there's things outside their movie, so they seek externally for Buddhahood. But by their very seeking for something out there, they lose it. Because that's using the Buddha to seek for Buddha and using mind to grasp mind. This will never work. Mind is like empty space in which there's no confusion or evil, as when the sun wheels through empty space, shining upon the four corners of the world. For when the sun rises and illuminates the whole earth, empty space doesn't get brighter. And when the sun sets, empty space does not get darker. You might say, yeah, it does. Look at the sky. That, isn't that empty space that gets brighter and darker? But actually, the empty space of the sky doesn't get darker and brighter. It's just the appearance of it to us is bright in daytime and dark at night. From the sky's point of view, it doesn't turn black or blue depending on the time of day or night. The phenomena of light and dark alternate with each other, but the nature of emptiness remains unchanged. So it is with the mind of the Buddha and of sentient beings. If you look upon the Buddha as presenting pure, bright, enlightened appearance, or upon sentient beings as presenting a foul, dark, or mortal-seeming appearance, these conceptions resulting from attachment to the characteristics or marks of Buddhas and sentient beings will keep you from complete wisdom. So if we make these distinctions between Buddhas and sentient beings, defined by the marks that we see out there, seems like the sentient beings are out there outside our mind. They have their own characteristics we can define them by. And so do Buddhas in our imagination. And if we compare them like that, then we won't awaken to this supreme knowledge even after many eons. There's only one mind and not a particle of anything else on which to lay hold. For this mind is Buddha. If you people of the way do not awake to this nature of mind, you will overlay mind with conceptual thought. You will seek the Buddha outside yourselves, and you will remain attached to the marks and characteristics and practices and so on, all of which are harmful and not at all the way to supreme awakening, Bodhi. So there's this mind that doesn't come and go like empty space, that light and dark pass through as the sun circles around. And we overlay it with conceptual thought. Almost continuously. We make it seem like it's out there with our conceptual thought. All this stuff that seems to be out there but is really not separate from mind. It seems to be out there because we're overlaying this one clear, spacious mind with conceptual thought. So Sashin's a time when we toss around some conceptual thoughts like tonight, but hopefully they aren't too disturbing. And it's a time when we just sit a lot in silence and let that conceptual overlay just drop off, and then it arises again pretty much the next moment, and we let it, watch it drop off, and it arises again. And if we sit long enough, it starts getting tired. The overlay, the conceptual overlay, starts getting tired of, like, keeps arising, and we keep letting go, keeps arising. It's like it doesn't have so much to do when we're just sitting there. It tries projecting all kinds of stuff for a while, and because there's less stuff to project onto, all the stuff to project onto is just like being churned up by past images and so on, because we're just looking at a wall the whole time. So I think that's one way of looking at Sesshin. It starts to get tired, the conceptual generator. The batteries start to wear down. I mean, you still find a lot of stuff, you know, to keep it charged up. So I was also suggesting this morning that as this is the first day of a 5-day Sesshin, to which you're all welcome to stop in, like at various times, like this evening, for example. After the Dharma talk, we'll have two more periods of Zazen. Anyone's welcome to stay. We'll have 7:30 till 9 each evening for the next 5 days. At any rate, some of us will just keep sitting. And I was suggesting that we look at when disturbance arises in Zazen. You can do this outside of Sesshin too. It's just harder to do. That's all. But in Sesshin, the disturbances get more maybe vivid. Little disturbances get more vivid. So you can kind of catch them almost all the time. And there's not so much escape from them. So it's kind of nice. We just can just check out our disturbances all day long. So I was suggesting that we notice disturbances arising, disturbances to the subtleness of Zazen, to we could even say it, disturbances to complete relaxation. There's a body and mind that can just sit and breathe out and just be here, completely relax. Even there might be some physical discomfort, but there can still be complete relaxation. But if there's not, if there's mental or physical disturbance to a completely relaxed present Jambudvipa being, then we can check out, is that disturbance related to some externality, something outside our movie, something other than this one mind? Without even trying to make the connection, I think it's just an interesting basic experiment to do with yourself. It's like, is there any disturbance to relaxed, open peace in any kind of, like, bit? Sometimes there's really big disturbances, right? But sometimes there's really little ones. It's like, I'm not even really thinking about anything, but I just feel a little kind of restless. And I just want to do something else. You know, and that might be even just a very just little movement of mind. might not be very disturbing, but if there's even a little disturbance, to just notice if at that time there's some sense of external objects, a world out there. That might seem like a really general kind of experiment, but I think we'll find that there is a sense of something out there, outside of mind, that's actually closely related to the disturbance. You could also do the reverse experiment, maybe, like, if there's no disturbance. Now, I think just in order to do the experiment, I think it would cause some disturbance. This is why I say maybe. Because just to even check if there's any externality, when there's no disturbance, creates a little externality, actually. But maybe retrospectively, you could add, if there's a moment of just complete settledness with no disturbance, then if the mind starts moving again, then you could ask, like, at that time, was there any sense of a world out there? And you might find that, no, actually, at that time, there was just this one mind. So some of you heard this kind of thing a lot, and maybe it sounds not so unusual, but some of you might not have heard this and it might sound really unusual, or you might have heard this many times and it still sounds really unusual, or still sounds like, really? Is all disturbance, I mean, we can say this in different ways. And we can say, you know, the cause of disturbance. We can say many different things about that in the realm of Buddha Dharma. But tonight I'm just proposing, can we say that when there's any disturbance, there's a sense of some externality, something outside the mind, outside our movie. And if we can really experientially for ourselves make that connection between the disturbance and that sense of externality, whether or not it's an actual sensory experience that's happening, like, you know, tasting a bad taste that's disturbing, or seeing a bad color that's disturbing, or something really obvious like that, or whether it's a very subtle mental projection of like a distant past memory of some cloud or something, you know, that even, and that might be very, very, very slightly disturbing. Might be, and oh, this is another point that that I forgot to mention about disturbance. When I say disturbing, it could be a pleasant disturbance too. Disturbance doesn't necessarily have to be painful. So like being like overly excited. You know, we're talking about it's disturbance to this completely relaxed, settled experience. So even like feeling a little jittery and in a positive way, like feeling like, you know, especially perky or something, could be slightly disturbing, actually. This is the way I'm talking about disturbance. Like a little, it's a little too perky, you know, because I'm thinking about that cloud that I'm imagining. It's such a great cloud. It perks me up. But, you know, this is maybe a weird kind of disturbance, but just to even look at those slight things like that and see, there's something outside, seem to be projecting something outside this one mind, that's like beyond the characteristics of perkiness, dullness, you know, depression, agitation, and all these disturbing mental states other than just complete relaxed peace. I know this is kind of rambly. Anything you want to do tonight? Maybe it's enough of this. Like sing a song or something, or ask a question.
This is really disturbing.
Wait a second. Are you outside my movie? Oh yeah, I can see you there on the screen. By the way, before you ask, I don't know if this will work for anybody, but this is a creative, imaginative thing, these types of meditations, and I was imagining my movie being projected on this spherical, bubble-like helmet. Not just around my head, maybe, but like I'm in a 10-foot diameter sphere. I was born in it. You all were born in yours too. And we're our mind is projecting a movie, a three-dimensional movie on this sphere like that. How's that work? To me, that it's just a weird imaginative image, but when I kind of get into that image, if I really kind of get into it, that you're all the projection of my movie on the sphere, that it's a very, very clear screen of sphere, so it looks really, really 3D. Even when I look around, it's really 3D. But if I kind of imagine this image, my body relaxes. It's a relaxing image for me. Is that weird? It might be a disturbing image to some people, I don't know, but to me it's relaxing. I feel like you all are a little bit less out there. You're no further than 5 feet away. The ones that seem like Jeff's back there, like about 30 feet away. He's actually really, the edge of my bubble's right here. You're really right here on my movie screen. So I feel closer to you. So we could make this imaginary bubble even smaller, maybe even 10 feet. Like it's just right, you know. It's very, very close. And there's nothing outside it. Anyway, so sorry for that little aside. You had a question.
I wonder if this is what mind only has done for you.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I think it's helped contribute to this really messy Dharma talk. You know, you gave up an evening of like you could have done, you know, you could have stayed home and watched a movie on a big screen. Yes. There's two of you. What? Could you speak at the same time, please?
Two questions. Do you have to wear imaginary 3D glasses? And what about subplots?
So, do you have to wear imaginary 3D glasses to watch this 3D movie? Yeah, I kind of feel like that's the kind of thing. This is a kind of warm-up. This isn't, what I'm talking about is not the realization of mind only that the Bhagavatara Sutra is talking about. I'm sad to say. This is like an imagination of it. And it's kind of like putting on 3D glasses in order to do it. But I kind of feel like it might be a step. Because if we don't kind of like try to try and very different versions of our world, then we just very easily fall back into the standard version that's like everything's out there much further than 10 feet and it's not just our own movie, it's real and it's external to mind. So these are really kind of weird, contrived, imaginary images, like living in a bubble and so on. But and you know, you can come up with your own. But it is kind of like putting on glasses. But eventually, we might take off the glasses. And I say, like, for me, it's quite interesting to, like, do this bubble, this contrived 3D glasses bubble meditation, to do it kind of wholeheartedly, like in Zazen, when, especially when it's, you know, more quiet and can kind of get more into it, and feel it, actually. And the experience, like I say, it's a little bit more relaxing. It's not completely relaxing, but and I think it's something to do with, like, it's gathering what seems to be out there, the mind pieces that seem to be, have strayed off out there. It's gathering them back a little bit closer into this 10-foot bubble. That bubble feels warmer than your way, than your 20 feet away. So there's a second question?
The second question was about subplots.
Oh, subplots. Subplots in the movie. Well, in a way, the movie is just, yeah, a whole bunch of strung together subplots. It's not, as you can see tonight, it's not a linear movie. And it's not, and it's not always, like, so well written. And and the subplots might not even go anywhere. We might think that they're going somewhere, like, so that what's I remember we had one class about this topic, I think, and one of the questions was, I keep feeling like there's a punchline coming. and like, I'm getting ready for the punchline. Like, most of these subplots have no punchline. They're just mind stuff churning around, doing its thing. Yeah. And Caroline.
There is a movie that does another flip or turn on this imagination, and it's called The Truman Show.
Oh, yes. I was wondering if that was the one you were going to say.
Has everyone seen that? Jim Carrey? He's contained in a world which he thinks is real, and everyone is playing a part in that world to persuade him of it, but they're doing it so that this Truman Show can be projected to the outside world so that others can observe it. And when he reaches, remember the incredible scene, the edge of that bubble?
Yep. He's in a big, really big bubble.
Yes.
A whole city-sized bubble.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And he understands what has been constructed to keep him within. I can't remember the end. Does he then find that it's all one?
I think what we see at the end is that he's in a boat on an ocean, and there's a painted horizon that looks like it's way out there, and boom, he hits the edge of the bubble. It's not out there. And then there's a little walkway or something, and then there's a door that goes out of the bubble. And I think the last scene in the movie is we see him walking out the door, but we don't see, that's the end. Because, unfortunately, we can't see what's outside the bubble.
My question is, what is he walking?
Yes, that's called the ultimate truth beyond all words and language and conceptions and ideas. Yeah. Yeah, I think so, yeah. And so in a way you could say this is sort of a two-part process, using the Truman Show as an example. You could say that we could have this two-step meditation. One, you know, or the before the first two steps, you could say, we just think that we're in this vast world of external things that are real and maybe have nothing to do with us, actually. Those crumpled papers on the side of the road have nothing to do with us. and then the first of the two steps would be like making the bubble, kind of imagining the bubble, which maybe is kind of like, well, can't we skip that step? But I think first we see that actually what seems to be not a bubble is a bubble. You know, I think that's this gathering the mind. It doesn't say like exploding the mind. Sashin is not exploding the mind out where there's no boundaries. It's gathering in all those seemingly external things into this bubble of nothing but mind. The first step, but it's not the whole story. Then you could say the second step is then to walk up to the door in the edge of the bubble and walk out into the unknown. Yes.
Well, using this movie and Truman Show analogy, not so much, well, maybe this kind of is a shame for me. I think part of gathering the mind is seeing the projectionist. You know, I mean, for me, that's always a big part of it, is when I actually become aware that I'm generating the content rather than just being enamored with the content.
Mm.
You know?
The projectionist.
It seems to be such an important part of it, because otherwise we're just captive to this entertaining, array that is being generated, but to actually realize, you know, that we are generating that.
Yeah, and we have to see who is this I that's generating it. But we did have this morning in the Lankavatara Sutra, we had this the teaching from the Buddha that was the projections of grasper and grasped. So that's like the projector, the projectionist, and the projections. It always comes with both, but it's not so much like we are this one mind that's projecting stuff. I think when we see that we're the projector, that's another projection. It's like there's the bubble, and then you could even say like in the center of the bubble is the, like a movie projector. But that is a creation of this one mind as well as the projection. So it's like both of them are created. And in a way, you could say the projector is also a kind of external to mind too. This is a subtle point here. We might say that we might think, well, the projector is the mind, and then the projections are the external to mind. But I would understand it that there's mind with no self or other, and then that's then the projections of a self, which the sutra calls the grasper, and other, the world, external objects, the grasped, both of those are projections. Because if you can find like this imaginary grasper, like the sense of me, like I, but I is not, I is a projection actually. You know, it's a projector and it's a projection. Does that make sense? That the self that we're thinking of as the one who does things and so on is actually a kind of movie-like projection also in Buddhism. Mm-hmm.
It seems like then it's just later, which just get peeled away, and you know, there's kind of, you know, there's a layer of realizing, oh, this is a projection, but then the next layer is, and that thought is generated by this.
Yeah, layers and layers. And of projection.
So there's no way to grasp it.
Yeah, so there's no way to grasp it. Mm-hmm.
Which we keep trying to do.
Well, we're just talking around. Like, in a way, you could say hopefully our talking about these things is like, you know, playing with peeling some of the layers. I think the danger is if we don't talk about it at all, we're just embedded in like thousands of layers of projection, and we don't even notice or do anything about them. So just by talking about it, we're at least like, oh, we see that there's all these layers, and maybe we peel back one, and that seems like the end, and then we see there's more underneath. Yes, Johnny.
If I'm off base, it seems that in this model, this gets closer to what something I can do something with, and that is whatever it is, and it's all unified. And what I project is exceptions to unity. When I see TV and a soldier getting blown up or something else, I say, I don't want that to be part of me. I project an exception to unity there.
Yeah. So you picked up on the all Buddhas and all sentient beings are only this one mind. You picked up on the one part, which is good.
Yeah, because I don't think I can really get too easy with like I woke up today and I projected an atrocity in Afghanistan. I'm not into that. But if what I find in this mind is something to which I take exception and make an exception of it, then I am suffering around that. And
if you put it outside the one
I make a distinction,
unity.
I make a distinction between me and that.
Mm-hmm.
However, it is a great Dharma gate for compassion. If all of a sudden I am aware this is a horrible thing and I'm not going to kick the dog. I'm going to be kinder to the checkout person at Safeway.
Hopefully it works this way.
But I find that when I project a differentiation, that's when the problem comes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When I can greet it, meet it with compassion, even though it's horrendous, it's a different experience.
And mm-hmm.
Because I don't think anywhere in one mind it's saying don't project anything. Just
we can't just stop.
Don't see the movie. Just smell the popcorn. Mm-hmm. I don't think it makes sense. Something is activating us. It's activating us. But I can add things to that. I can add distinction. I can add don't like it or I like it or whatever.
Mm.
But that's the real projection, I think. Not so much what activates me.
And I think your point about compassion is really important, and I know we've talked about before, but in these types of discussions, it's good to remember that you might think that if you see that it's all a movie, it's all our movie, that then why bother helping? Those suffering beings aren't really real. But in fact, it's experientially, it seems to be more like we're more intimate with everything because there's less separation. So again, even for me to do this bubble movie meditation thing where I feel like all of you are less out there, you're actually closer to me even on my screen, for me it actually does create a feeling of actually being closer, and therefore if there's some suffering on that screen, it's very close to home, and we naturally want to respond to it. I think partly too, it's like we have this we're naturally compassionate beings. I think living beings are naturally compassionate. So that part doesn't go away unless we just distort this with some weird conceptual thing that just like tries to escape the fact that we're compassionate beings or something. But otherwise, it's just a way to bring to gather the beings who need help, the objects of compassion, gather them into this one mind, so that we can then really meet them. Yes.
I think Patrick's in the blind spot of your projector.
Oh yes. And he looks like he's way out there. But but you're also closer than my eyeball.
Can you say something more about this mind that we are only? Is it the same mind that has the eight consciousnesses?
Oh yeah, that's another question about Huang Bo's one mind. Because we've been studying the eight consciousnesses. Is it one of those consciousnesses? And I would propose that actually that, you know, Huang Bo doesn't say this, but I would propose that it's the storehouse consciousness, Alaya Vijnana, which in the Lankavatara Sutra is seen in one particular light. It is the Tathagata Garbha. It's the storehouse of the Buddha. It's not just the storehouse of karmic obscurations.
Say that last sentence again.
The storehouse consciousness?
Yeah.
We haven't discussed this so much in the sutra so far, but in this Lankavatara Sutra, one of its special features is that the storehouse consciousness, which is usually a storehouse of karmic obscurations, all our karmic activity is creating this unconscious, huge unconscious mind that's like who we are in a way. And that's the one mind, but also this storehouse consciousness is also called Tathagata Garbha, or Buddha nature, completely unobscured Buddha nature. So very interesting thing in the sutra that those two are not two. So therefore we can say all Buddhas and all sentient beings, in other words, all completely, perfectly pure, unobscured Buddhas and all the karmically obscured sentient beings together are this one mind. And we can call it the storehouse consciousness, or we can call it Buddha nature. It's like seen from a different angle. Like the true nature of the storehouse consciousness is Buddha nature. So I think both of those are included in this one mind of Huang Bo. Therefore, it can... And this is what's happened, like... you know, he says... I didn't read the whole section from this morning, but you know, this one mind, right? It's not any color. It has no characteristics. It's not in the realm of things that exist or don't exist. It's not old or new, and so on. So it seems like something really, you know, like some strange abstract Buddha mind, right? But then Huang Bo says, it's that which you see before you. This is it, what we're experiencing right now. After hearing all that stuff, it neither existed nor non-existent. It's like this Buddha mind. It's that which you see before you. But begin to reason about it and you at once fall into error. So as soon as you say, even to reason about it as far as saying, here it is, Buddha mind. It's like, already we fall into error. But that's what makes me think too, that if Buddha nature was something, if this one mind was Buddha nature, completely purified of all our imaginations, then it wouldn't appear before us right now. But Huang Bo says, it appears before you right now. Us. Measly little sentient beings, just like, you know, yakking away about movies and stuff. All this stuff that appears before us is this one mind. Amazing, huh? I must feel I hope I didn't offend it. This great Buddha mind that's like majestically radiating upon us. But then, how silly, right? Because it can't be offended. I hope I didn't, totally defile the precious Dharma by this, like, completely unprepared talk. But luckily, that can't happen to it. I might have wasted your time, but yes, Kathy.
Little raggle-taggle talks that drift and float around.
Raggle-taggle talks. Yes. Yes, yeah. For better or worse. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Could you tell us about Teisho? Do you know?
Teisho.
The Roshi gives a Dharma talk.
I've sometimes heard of it. Teisho is translated as presenting the shout. Maybe that's a loose translation. But, So traditionally, Teisho is kind of an unplanned thing. Yeah. And I was going to bring up this other story about Huangbo. Huangbo has the story where a bunch of people are in a Dharma talk like this, right? And he said, like, what are you people doing? Why did you come here? Are you looking for something? You go around quoting like the Lankavatara Sutra and the ancestors and the Truman Show and these things, but that's all slurping dregs. Dreg slurpers are people who go around like quoting sutras and stuff. So that's why I didn't bring it up tonight, because it's so embarrassing.
Major,
especially me. I just bring these things, dregs, and slurp it up. And he said, Huangbo says, if you go on like this, slurping up the dregs of the ancients, how will you have today? Don't you know, in all of China, there are no teachers of Zen? Maybe that's something about Teisho too. There are no teachers of Zen. Yes?
Yeah, sometimes I have to bring in another religion. Is it Judaism, the Akashic Records? You heard that term?
I've heard it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Now, doesn't that mean everything that's ever happened and maybe everything that will happen?
Huh.
Has anyone else studied that or know that? Akashic?
Is there anything outside the Akashic Record? Does anyone know?
Well, I was just...
If there's nothing outside it, then it must be the one mind. Because there's only one thing that nothing's outside of, right? It's not really a thing, but there can't be more than one realm that nothing's outside of, by definition, right? So if there's nothing outside the Akashic Record, then it's the one mind that's Buddha's, all Buddhas and sentient beings. There's nothing inside it either, yeah. Which is partly why this thing of, when we talk about gathering all those external things back here, we have this tendency to think that the mind is located somewhere in relation to like the brain or something in here, but the mind has no location. It has no inside or outside. But we're very external oriented creatures. So again, as a kind of like, in a two-step process, you could say the first step is kind of like saying things like the kingdom of God is within. But that's only the first step, you know. The second step is the kingdom of God's not within, but definitely not without. But it has no, the kingdom of God can't have some location like inside, in what, right? Within what? Yes.
All expressions of the one mind, so it can play with itself?
Yeah, we're expressions of the one mind. so it can play with itself. Are you enjoying the play? If we keep talking, we can maybe, maybe the Sesshin people can avoid a period of zazen. But, you know, whether we're sitting with we're external words or internal words, it's not really that different. So, what do you think?
Nothing, hopefully.
Nothing, hopefully. How will you have today? How will you have today?
How will I have today?
Sunny side up.
Because we wouldn't want it to be over easy. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.